Good afternoon. I'm Chuck Skypick with the Brewers Association, and you are in training effectiveness, why your staff still makes mistakes. Just a few little housekeeping things. We'll leave some time at the end of the presentation for questions. Since we are recording this to be available later, if you would please, for your questions, step up to either one of the microphones here in the center aisles. So I'm going to give you guys a twofer on this introduction, and the official thing I need to say here is this presentation is Dave Heisen. Dave is a professional of occupational safety and health at Grand Valley State University. Prior to working in an academic setting, Dave worked as a practicing safety professional and industrial hygienist for 27 years. He has a master's degree from the University of Michigan and is a certified industrial hygienist. He's a recipient of multiple grants from MyOSHA, that's Michigan OSHA, and the Brewers Association to provide online occupational safety training modules for craft brewers. Dave's research includes innovations in safety training of workers and exposures to carbon dioxide in craft breweries. So that's the official introduction. And I'll give you a little bit more personal one. I met Dave in January of 2014, so just a little bit over 3 years ago. And I met Dave at a Michigan Brewers Guild annual meeting. And Dave had a presentation where he was producing for Michigan OSHA training videos targeted at training in breweries. And, you know, some great shots, you know, shots of brewers working in breweries. And, you know, so many things with so many safety situations are the same in any industrial setting. But when you can see it, in the environment you're working in, it really makes a difference. And so Dave and I started a conversation about, you know, wouldn't this be great if we could take this to a national level? And so roughly a year and a half after that conversation, in September of 2015, the Brewers Association launched our brewery training, online brewery safety training modules. How many people here have participated in that online brewery safety training? Okay. Thank you very much. And so in the 18 months, and Dave's going to have these numbers as well in his presentation, in the 18 months that that resource has been available, we've had over 4,000 registered users. We've had over 15,000 courses completed. And in terms of individual video segments watched, we have over 78,000 individual brewery segments watched. And it's been one of our most used resources at the Brewers Association, and we feel like it's really one of our most useful. And, you know, it's great that we're not aware. We're always aware of accidents happening in breweries, but nothing serious, and we just hope that's played a role. No good as far as safety and injuries go. No news is good news, right? So I'm totally appreciative of Dave's work, and without further ado, Dave Heisen.
And I always like to start out with a humorous video, so I'm waiting for her. Just clicking the arrow. There we go. All right. So I want to ask you a question. So some of you have seen the online training, but a lot of times when we talk about safety and health training, I look at this group, and there's a large group here. And when somebody talks about safety and health training, what's the first thing that goes through your mind? Okay. I want to be here. I love to do it. I can't wait to, you know, see the next thing that comes out. And a lot of times some of our training ends up looking like this when we get somebody new.
One of those
So, you know, and this is what it often looks like. And, you know, safety takes a back seat. And, you know, one of my pet peeves is seeing companies that talk about safety first. Because in the grand scheme of things, safety is never first. Okay? Safety needs to be a part of what we do, but we can never use it as a priority. When we use a safety as a priority, it gets shuffled. Because, okay, we need to get this out today. We need to package this. Oh, yeah, and do it safely. It's always an add-on, and it's always something extra. In fact, there's a beer that's made. Does anybody know what it's called? By Dark Horse in Jackson, Michigan. Smells like a safety meeting, okay? And if you smell the beer, it has a new aroma to it that smells a lot like burning hemp or, say, marijuana, okay? And so that smells like a safety meeting. Wonderful beer, but now where did that elevate safety in that? Okay? So now we look at safety as a meeting as a way not to necessarily learn about what we need to do or create it as a value. I heard a lot of talk about values this morning at your opening session. And safety really needs to be a value. And I'm very passionate about this. I teach occupational safety and health professionals. I worked in industry for a lot of years. I've seen a lot of people get injured. You're going to hear me tell some stories about that in a little bit. But we also started out with a Ben Franklin quote, right? Tell me and I forget, teach me and I remember, involve me and I learn. Okay? And my objectives for today, so, you know, we want to be able to be people involved in the process. And one of the things that we did as an objective when we put together the online safety training through a grant from the state of Michigan was to try to see if we could involve people in an online environment. It's not always easy to do. So what I want to do today is to talk, first of all, about adult learning theories, because adults learn differently than children, and what aspects of that. So we're going to talk about adult learning theory. We're going to talk about learning styles and the way people learn. Everybody learns a little bit differently. When we start talking about these learning styles, you're all going to think about your different learning style because everybody has a unique style. So when we go out to train people and to try to train them, we're going to have different learning styles, and we have to try to cater to those different learning styles about how to learn. One comment that we got back on the Brewers Association training is why you're repeating the same things that I'm reading, or actually, you know, that the same thing is printed there. Well, some people learn in a visual environment, and some people learn through reading, and they're just trying to get to different learning styles. We're going to talk about facilitated learning. So rather than focus on learning styles, this is another approach to training, where facilitated learning styles, where we try to actually focus on the goals of what we want to get accomplished, what we want people to learn. And based on what we want people to learn, then we can go about training in that manner about the ways that best get to that point. And then even though we train people, okay, they're still going to make mistakes. So I'm going to take you through a little bit of human error basics about why people make mistakes. We are inefficient machines, okay? and very inefficient machines. And then I'm going to talk to you a little bit about instructional design that we used to create the online safety training that we produced, and then talk about some of the results that we got. So, you know, how many here just, you know, when I say safety training, you have just that warm, fuzzy feeling? Okay? Why are you here? What brought you here? I'm asking you a question. What brought you here? Why do you want to learn about this? Keep people from getting hurt. Okay? Why else? Okay? Yeah, we got this big regulatory body that, you know, comes around and tells us we have to train people. Okay? Did they tell you how to train people? The regulators? You get a list of objectives, and this is what I have to cover. So, not necessarily helpful. Are there resources that they provide? Yeah, there's some resources they provide, but you still got to go out there and train people and try to get them to learn. Which also gives me, I want to talk real briefly, and I skipped over in the Ben Franklin quote, but it's just coming back to me now. is that there's a difference between training and education. Okay? Anybody know what the difference between training and education is? I have an easy way to produce it. So as you were growing up, or if you were sending your kids to school right now, do you want them to have sex training or sex education? That kind of highlights the difference between, we went for what? Driver's training. We didn't go for driver's education. Okay. So training is this piece where people need to be involved in it. They're not going to learn if they're not going to be involved in it. You know, I lecture to my students. I joke that I speak in 50-minute increments, then stop. Then for 10 minutes, then I start speaking in 50-minute increments again. Except on Tuesdays and Thursdays, then it's an hour and 25 minutes, then I stop. But just for the length of the classes that I do. But I'm educating students, and it's a totally different approach. But we also have to provide some ways that they can put the pieces together as well. All right. So, adult learning theory. Okay. So, I always start out this is the challenges, this is the Beloit mindset list. And if you've never read the Beloit mindset list, this is something we have educators do because we learn something about our audience. Okay. I came here today, you know, I'm wandering around the exhibit hall with Grand Valley State University on, and people are looking at me like, why are you here? You know, from the standpoint. Because, you know, yeah, I'm kind of a fish out of water. I need to learn about my audience. I need to learn what you guys need. And you need to learn that ahead of time. So some of the challenges with the Beloit Mindset List with the incoming freshman class, okay, is that they never heard Harry Carey, you know, try to sing in the seventh inning at Wrigley Field. Vladimir Putin has always been calling the shots at the Kremlin for their entire life. The United States has always been at war. They never had to watch or listen to programs at a scheduled time. So, you know, I remember the days where I was the remote control for my dad. Okay? You know, change that channel. If you want to reach them, you have to send a text. Never send an email. I send emails out to my students that come to class and said, I never saw that. I says, well, I don't have your number to text you because I know you'd read that, but you don't read anything that I send you via email. And it's true these days. Texting is the only way to communicate with them. Okay? A Bush or a Clinton have always been campaigning for something good, big. Okay? John Elway and Wayne Gretzky have always been retired. Okay? And Bluetooth has always been around. Okay? So amazing. In 3 years, okay, is it? Yeah, I think it's 3 years, the class of 2024 will not have been alive when 9/11 happened. Okay? So it makes me think that I'm old when I hear that, but you know, you don't realize that. So it doesn't, so how you train people and the experiences that they've had aren't the same. They're constantly changing. When we talk about adult learning theory, we use a different word than we talk about for children. Children is called pedagogical, and andragogical is when we talk about adult learning theory. The biggest difference between adults and children is that adults need to know why they're there, why they need to learn, what's important about it, what do they need, okay? So these are some things that you need to consider when you're doing your training, is that the employees need to have some buy-in. What's their motivation? Is their motivation time away from work? Or is it required? Is it mandated training? So those are some aspects that you need to think about. Do you spend time on the why? Why am I here for this training? Is there any time at all spent on it? Are there experiences relied on and valued? I want you guys to give me your experiences as we go along, and if you've got questions about your experiences in training, about what you may have experienced training. When you look around an audience and you see half of the people in the back snoozing, I tell my students when they got their laptops up, I walk up and down the rows because most of the time they're shopping for shoes. I tell them shoes, and it, anyway. So I have no idea why I chose shoes, but But they, you know, to make sure that people are engaged in the training that they're looking at. Okay? Are they free to learn on their own? So one of the reasons we did an online training that's done in an asynchronous manner is that people can learn on their own, and they can learn on their own pace. And that's important for adults. Okay? And is more than one medium used? So are we talking about video? Are we talking about audio? Are we talking about just reading? Everybody learns in a different way. And this brings us to our learning styles. The first one I want to talk about is VARC. Okay? VARC stands for visual learner. So how many here maybe think they're a visual learner? They learn by looking. Lots of visual learners. How many here auditory? By hearing. Not too many. So I'm going to challenge you, because more of you may be auditory than what you read. How many people just read? That's the only way they learn. They have to read. A few of you just for reading. And how many people have to be involved in it? Kinesthetic, okay? So some of you are raising your hand for multiple times. So sometimes we try to classify people in a learner and go to their one style. Well, we made advances a little bit, and one of the next ones was a Paragon Adult Learning Styles Inventory. Some of you may have taken this in a different format, okay? But there are four dimensions that they look at. And they look at whether you're more of an introvert or an extrovert. They look at whether you're intuition or sensation, whether I get it by intuition or I need to touch. Okay? Thinking or feeling. Okay? Whether I need to think about something or whether I just feel it. Okay? And then judging or perceiving, where we want to either judge something or we're perceiving it happening. So, and, you know, you have to understand your learning style yourself, because I'm up here and I know what my learning style is, and my learning style makes me or forces me to do things differently than I would otherwise. And so they have this. So as an introvert, okay, teaching extroverts, okay, they want to use group work. Sometimes they want need more wait time in there. They want to provide time for movement. In value expression. But you can see this, judges and perceivers. So a judge or teaching a perceiver needs to have flexibility in assignments, need to be able to use variety. So these are some things that you need to do when you're teaching that. But you don't know what everybody's learning style is and how they fit into these four dimensions unless you all take this, wonderful test. So Gardner came out with multiple intelligence, and this slide is going to be a little bit difficult to read, and I put the web address up there. But Gardner takes it and breaks down multiple intelligences into a bunch of different groups where we talk about visual and spatial, body and kinesthetic, musical, interpersonal, intrapersonal, okay, linguistic or logical. So, and I don't know if that's still around, but on many of these, you can still take Gardner's test, and it'll tell you what you are. So, here's my result. Okay. So, I took this, and I'm very visual and spatial. Okay. If you ask me for directions, I have to look at a map. If I look at a map, I'm knowing where I'm going. When I came here before Washington, D.C., I looked at the map so I knew where my hotel was, where everything is, and when I got here, I could walk right to it, okay? Because I'm very visual and very spatial, okay? And that's the highest one. Naturalistic, what they refer to as nature smart, okay? I'm a bird watcher, a very avid bird watcher. Had a bald eagle fly over my house the other day, got really excited. I'm running in the house hollering to my wife, okay? Doesn't happen very often where I live. So, very nature smart, and that's what I did in college. My undergraduate degree is in biology. I love that part of it. I'm not very body smart. I am very uncoordinated, in a matter of fact. Okay, linguistic, something I need to work on as far as being word smart. Logical, I am number-oriented and very logical. And you look at these, and these are opposite of each other, but those are end up being my highest. Musical, I'm not musical at all. And that's the auditory piece, okay? I don't, how many here like to listen to music while they're studying or they're doing something? I mean, I look on the plane and I'm just looking at all the earphones in people. I don't ever wear them. Okay? I'd rather read. Okay? Or something like that. So that ends up being, you know, that's my lowest one, okay? And whether I'm smart about myself, intrapersonal, or other people smart, I'm just kind of in the average part. But this allows you to understand a little bit about yourself and your learning styles. So, and that helps you when you're out training somebody about, these are the ways that I learn, but what are some of the ways that somebody else learns? Okay? How many people, when you're doing safety training, do any type of hands-on safety training where we end up being body smart, where people are actually, you know, putting some things on. So you have experience with some of those things, okay? All right. So the other type of learning, and I'm trying to go through this stuff, you know, the professor in me comes out and I have to go through all the background here. That's why. But the other thing is facilitated learning. So I'm going to have to, you guys are going to help me out here in a little bit. But we focus on the ways, on what the outcome is. So what do I want to happen from my safety training? You know, is it about building skills? Is it about acquiring knowledge? Is it about developing critical and creative thinking? Is it cultivating problem solving and decision making? Exploring attitudes? Practicing professional judgment? Okay, or reflecting on experience? So based on what outcome I have, I may look at different ways of learning here, where I'm going to do behavioral learning, I'm going to do cognitive learning, inquiry. And if you actually look at the book, this is from Davis and Arndt, if you actually look at their book, they'll tell you, you know, so when are case studies appropriate? When do you want to do some other different types of things in your training so people have the ability to learn? And I recommend it. It's a great book. They have a lot of research in it. But the basic part of it is where we can look at how we want to learn. So if I'm exploring attitudes, I'm going to be doing group planning in teams, virtual reality, even for practicing professional judgment. So lots of different types of ways. Okay. So what outcomes, okay, do we need in safety and health training of breweries? So if I look at these outcomes, what ones stand out to you? We can't do them all. What do you want to accomplish? What do you want your brewers to have afterwards? Okay. Acquiring knowledge. How else? Okay. Attitudes, exploring attitudes. Okay. Professional judgment, you know, making good and I would actually go from professional judgment up to a couple more, but decision-making, right? We want them to make good decisions out there. So when we look at that, and does that change, okay, if I was designing a training session specifically for confined space entry? So if I'm going to train somebody on confined space entry, what do I need to do? Acquiring knowledge? Decision-making? What else may be on there? Okay, professional judgment. Okay, oops, going the wrong way. All right, so we have, you know, different ways of outcomes, and it'll tell us what type of training that we need to do. Okay, I look at this as being the three things that we want people from a safety and health training standpoint. You guys went for professional judgment, I went to building skills. Okay, so there are some common methods for building skills. There's some common methods in training for acquiring knowledge. There's some common methods about when we talk about cultivating decision-making. Okay, cultivating decision-making are great for case studies. So rather than doing your training, talk about a case and talk about that and help them make the decision. There are some great confined space videos out there that allow people to show them a case and then figure out what they should be doing to make a decision. Okay, acquiring knowledge. Okay, that's what you guys are here for. That's what I'm interacting. Okay, acquiring knowledge is generally an instructor-led type of a presentation where I'm trying to impart some sort of knowledge on you and hopefully did that. I graded exams on the way here from my last industrial hygiene exam. I shouldn't have done it because all it did was say, okay, where were they for the last 4 weeks? Okay. You know, from that standpoint. And that's the way I feel. But sometimes I also look at how I presented it. Where was I in those last 4 weeks, and why are they missing so much? So acquiring knowledge is that way. Building skills is going to be hands-on, okay? So building skills is going to be a method where people are actually touching, feeling, and doing it, okay, to build those particular type of skills. So facilitated learning is a great way to look at my how I'm going to design my training to be able to come up with people to make good decisions. All right. The power of stories. You guys heard it this morning, right? Okay. Allison Levine, what did she do? She told a story, okay? And that story had lessons in it. And the power of stories is huge, okay? We use stories to make a point. Become a good storyteller, okay? Use somebody else's stories from that standpoint, okay? Stories help us figure things out, okay? Case studies are a form of a story. So I've got some examples for you. I worked for 27 years in industry. I worked in a lot of different types of industry. So one of the things that I from a case study standpoint, is lockout tagout. We're all familiar with lockout tagout, right? Okay. We know what we need to do with lockout tagout. Sometimes it's a real pain. Tell you a story about lockout tagout. We had a maintenance guy, okay? And I'll use Bill as his name. Maintenance guy. Friendliest guy, nicest guy you wanted to know. And he was always helping us out when we needed something. You know, I learned early on in my health and safety profession that if you want to get anything done, you make friends with the maintenance guy, okay? Because then he will go out and get that stuff done for you when you really need it to be fixed. And so I got, you know, I knew him. Well, he went to do a small job with another guy, okay? Everybody in the crew was gone to lunch, and he had to shut off a ventilation system that has a big squirrel cage fan in it. And he went up to change some belts on the squirrel cage fan, and he didn't lock it out because they were only going to be up there for 15 minutes. So they went up there to change the belts, and things got away from them a little bit, took them a little bit longer, and they were in the process of changing the belts when the people came back from lunch. And lo and behold, the ventilation system's not running. So what's the first thing they do? They turned it back on. Bill lost both of his arms at the elbow and would have been sucked totally in the machine if the guy behind him hadn't pulled him out, and the guy behind him pulling him out lost three fingers. Okay, just that quick. For a job that they've done a million times, for lockout that they've done a million times, for lockout that they could have just put a lock on and spent an extra 2 minutes to do, but they didn't do it, and they didn't let anybody know about it. We had, I worked for Pfizer in Kalamazoo, pharmaceutical manufacturer. And we were having a problem with, because they never wore hard hats in this facility. Well, we started wearing hard hats. And we had to convince people to wear hard hats. And no matter how much we convinced them, it's just like, you know, a lot of the breweries when we first went to them, and actually every one of them when we first started making these videos, every one of those breweries that we went to, nobody was wearing safety glasses. Okay? Unless they were handling chemicals, then they wore safety glasses. And you want to know what? Today, every single one of them does. Only because we talked about it, and we talked about stories that we've seen. Same thing with hard hats at Pfizer. They've never worn them before, so now you're going to make me put this hat on here? We heard all the excuses. Oh, this is going to be worse for me. This is, you know, this is going to cause me all kinds of problems. This is these hard hats are a safety hazard. Okay? And then what we did, we had an event that happened where a maintenance guy was working on something that had high pressure, and one of the bolts went off, and it hit his hard hat and gouged him. And if he wasn't wearing his hard hat, he would have been dead. And so what we did was we had him make a 30-second, or actually about a 2-minute video that we played on every one of the monitors at Pfizer of him telling the story about and showing his hard hat and the dent that it put into it. And you want to know what? Never heard another complaint about hard hats again. because it came from one of their peers, and it was a story, and they know what could have happened. And too often when we talk about safety and health, it's always the, you know, it's always going to be the other guy. It's never us, okay? And I have more stories. I have, and I'm not going to tell that one, so. I visualize these stories because I see them in my head yet, okay? I had a person operating a high-low, just operating a fork truck. How many of you here may have three-wheel high-lows? Two in the front and a middle one in the back, okay? Well, the operator's compartment is right near where that other wheel is. And the person that was operating it was left-handed. And she was operating this fork truck in as a left-handed person, but she wanted to use her left foot for what's referred to as the dead pedal. And she was using, instead of plugging, she was raising the dead pedal for a brake. And so she had her right foot at the very edge and using her left foot to raise a pedal, and she had her right foot at the very back edge of the high-low. Well, she hit a bump, and her foot slipped off, and the high-low ran onto her foot. Not necessarily a huge problem, but with an adrenaline rush, she pulled her foot out of her boot. Okay, and I don't know if you know what degloving is. They talk about that with hands, but she degloved her foot. Never came back to work again. So I was in charge of getting the boot with to see if they could salvage any of the skin out of it for grafts or anything, which they couldn't at that point. But, you know, and I see these stories, and, you know, I know Linda. I know who she was, okay? A great person, and just like that, she never worked in that facility again, okay? All right, enough of the stories, okay? But stories have power. Okay, so tell stories to people. All right. So human error basics, why people make mistakes. The first one is knowledge. Okay, and knowledge, the first one is ignorance. Ignorance is I didn't know. So somebody was never trained, they never experienced that, they didn't know. The second one is what I refer to as pseudo-knowledge. That means I know, that's what they tell you, but they really don't know. The next one is imprudence. And imprudence also goes to complacency. Actually, the last two go to complacency, which Allison talked about this morning. Okay? Complacency. Imprudence is, it's not going to happen to me. Okay. You know, if I told you that there's a Myosha case, Myosha death or whatever, where somebody died falling from a folding chair, okay, would you believe me? It happened. Somebody got up on a folding chair, fell off of it, and hit their head, and died about a week later. Okay? On a folding chair. You know, how often do we stand on a chair at home, wherever, where we take those risks? But we always have that risk that it's not going to happen to me. Okay? So imprudence is that, you know, safety events don't happen all the time. It's not something constant. In fact, you know, one of the reasons we have a hard time selling people on safety is because safety, if you remember these three words today, safety is uncomfortable, it's inconvenient, and inefficient. Okay? And that's what we have to overcome, okay, when we try to train people on safety, because that's the attitude they're coming in with, that those three things. Okay? So we end up with imprudence. It's not going to happen to me. And apathy is just, I don't care. Okay, just let me do my job. I don't care. I'm going to do it the way I want to do it. All right. Okay. The other one are cognitive errors. Okay. So cognitive errors happen a lot. Some of these happen a lot as you get older. So the first one is loss of activation. So in behavioral psychology, it's activator behavior consequence. But we need an activator to get us to go do the behavior. Okay. And so we get loss of activation. So this is when you walk into a room and you forget why you were there. And then you have to retrace your steps, right? And as I get older, that happens to me more and more. That I forget why I was there. Okay? Loss of activation, those type of things. Okay? Description. Description errors when two things look similar. Okay? And we choose the wrong one because they look similar. Okay? If you look at Three Mile Island, when they had the incident at Three Mile Island where we, you know, could have made Philadelphia a wasteland, All the buttons on the controls look the same. So how do I know which one to choose? Those are description errors. My wife does this to me. We have the recycle bin and the trash bin next to each other. Okay? The recycle bin's bigger and the trash bin's smaller. She'll switch positions where they are. Guess what goes in the recycle and what goes in the trash? Okay? Because I'm used to them being in that one position. Even though they look different, that's a description error. So if you change things in your workplace, workers are going to get screwed up because they look the same. The last one is capture. And we've all experienced capture. Capture is where our mind is somewhere else, and we're going through the decisions on a cognitive basis on a, you know, on automatic pilot. So how many here have ever driven somewhere, and when you got there, you wondered how in the hell you got there? Okay? You're going like, man, you know, I'm driving along. I mean, did I stop for that stop sign? Did I stop at that red light I should have? You have no memory of it, do you? Okay? Because your mind was somewhere else. And people make capture errors all the time. We do routine tasks over and over and over again. And if something new or different's in there, we're still going to do the capture. And we're going to forget about it. Okay? And if the light I come to during that capture is always normally green, I go through it. But, you know, the day I go through there, maybe they made it red. Okay? And end up with a capture error. Those are just cognitive errors. There's a lot more cognitive errors that we can make. But this is just part of our inefficiency. We don't process things right. Okay? So I'm going to give you an example of cognitive errors. If you've seen this before, please don't spoil it for your neighbor. This has been out there for a while. And I don't know if I can start it from here. No, I can't. Hang on a second. There's a test after this. Oops, hang on, I got to get your opinion. Oops. How many people said 15? Okay. How many people said 15? Okay. Did anybody see something unusual? How many people saw the gorilla? How many people didn't see the gorilla? Do you realize there was a gorilla in there? And he was there for a long time. Okay. And I'm going to fast forward this. Let me go back. Just so you know that there was a gorilla there, and I'm not messing with you. I can't hear. Let's do the mouse way. So they do it in slow-mo. There's the gorilla. Here's it in regular motion. For those of you who missed it, he was there for a while. Beat his chest even, then walk through. You realize that 40%... So about 40% of people don't see that, okay? And we wonder how people miss something. We say, gee, how could you miss that, you know, from a safety? Somebody has an incident at your work. How could you miss that, okay? So just think about that for those of you who missed the gorilla, okay? That when our attention is selected, they did this other study where they have a guy on a it comes through with a door, and they completely change the guy giving directions to somebody that he already started giving directions to, and 60% of the people didn't realize they changed people. And they don't look anything alike. Okay? And you wonder why eyewitness accounts differ so very? Some of this thing. Interpersonal, okay? So I'm not going to talk about, we talk about stress and that in a little bit, but peer pressure, okay? So if I go to a construction site, And I try to do safety and health training, if I don't convince the guy who basically runs the job site and how it's supposed to happen, it's not going to happen. Because the peer pressure is going to be that, no, we don't need to do all that stuff. Okay? That type of thing. So peer pressure has a big thing. Power of authority.
If I told you here 60% of people in this room would kill somebody, how many would say yes? If you're familiar with some work that was done, there's a couple of them with power of authority. First is the Stanford Prison Experiments. Okay. The other one is I'm trying to, all of a sudden now I draw a blank. This is loss of activation because I forgot what, you know, first of all, my alarm's going off telling me I got a few minutes left. Okay. Second thing is that I'm drawing a blank on Stanley Milgram. Did an experiment in the 1950s where he had people give electrical shock to somebody else. It didn't actually happen. And the researcher said you had to go to electrical shock. They gave people 440 volts, enough to kill them. And for the last part of it, the guy quit complaining, like he was dead already. Okay? And 60%, they repeated the experiment, and it was 70%. So amazing that power of authority, where you're listening to an authority and they're telling you to do something, people will do it. It has a huge impact. The Stanford prison experiments are very similar to Abu Ghraib that happened in Iraq, where these normal soldiers started having authority over these prisoners and they started becoming abusive. And that's something that just happens from a power of authority standpoint. Stress. What's going on in people's life? Stress can have a big impact on why they make errors. Okay? Some errors in judgment. We're going to talk about heuristics. And heuristics are mental shortcuts we make because we have to make thousands and thousands and thousands of decisions every day, every hour. And when we make those decisions, we use something called heuristics. We use mental shortcuts. And I'll give you an example of this. Okay? And I have to read this because I screwed it up on two presentations, so I'm not going to screw it up this time. All right. I got to see how far I am, too. I'm getting pretty good. All right. So, you guys have to answer this quickly, okay? So, a bat and a ball together cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? What? 10 cents. Sure. How much does it cost? Five, right? You guys all got it right. How come? Because you heard this before or what? If I do this to my students, everybody says 10. It took me 10 minutes to convince my wife that she was wrong when she said 10. Okay? You guys, hey, you know the I'm never using that one in a group of brewers again. Okay? But it's a mental shortcut where we'd automatically think 10 cents. Okay? So we do a lot of different mental shortcuts. And there's different ones that we make. Oops, I'm going to go back. Got a few of them written down here, and I want to make sure I don't miss them before we jump into the results of the training. So with the heuristics or whatever that when we're talking about, a couple of them are the anchoring rule. So an anchoring rule is when you tell somebody a number, okay, they're going to estimate closer to whatever number if it was lower or higher. This happens in, you know, we get duped by marketers all the time with the anchoring rule, okay? So, if I ask you, are there more letters that start with K in English than have K as a third letter? Tell me. You don't have to be right. What? Are there more letters that start with K or more letters that have the third letter? Are there more words that start with the letter K or more words that have K as a third
letter?
Okay, you guys, third letter? Anybody say first letter? Okay. So what was the first word that popped in your mind? Yeah.
King.
Okay, what was the first word that popped in your mind?
King.
King, first letter?
Acknowledge.
Okay. Well, there is three times many more, just to let you know for fun fact, you don't need to know this. There's three times as many more that have K as a third letter. But it's whatever you come up with first. Whatever you're thinking of, that's called the availability heuristic. So what we think about in our mind, okay, is going to tell us what we have. The last one is the rule of typical things, okay? And the rule of typical things is we make judgments on people without even talking to them, don't we? We see somebody on the street, we see somebody in our brewery, and we make judgments about them based on how they look, what they do for a job, okay? I should have looked at the reactions when I walked around and talked to some of your different vendors and told them I was a professor and didn't do anything with the breweries, okay? You want to know how much time you want to spend talking to me? Not a lot, okay? Get out of here, all right? Okay? But they made judgments about me, okay? They didn't know that I was starting a brewery. I'm not, so. Okay? Yeah, thanks, Chuck. All right, so instructional design for the Brewers Association. We'll talk about the results here in a little bit. We wanted to do online so it could be self-paced and asynchronous. That was one of the things. We wanted to train by job task instead of subject matter. So if you look at the Brewers Association, the training is based on what the people are going to do in their job. So you're getting lockout, tagout training about six different ways. You're getting, you know, stuff about chemical handling in about three or four of these different sessions, okay, of the lessons. So we did a lot, okay? We wanted video segments that were no longer than 2 to 3 minutes, because guess what happens after they're more than 3 minutes? Okay, you're tuned right out. The attention span is about 2 to 3 minutes that we do. We wanted to put first-person viewpoint in there. So we used some GoPro footage and had fun with some brewers wearing some GoPros. Okay? So when we measure training effectiveness, we look for increase the training transfer. And how we do that is we measure four phases. We look at reaction or satisfaction surveys. So I'm going to talk to you real briefly about the results of the satisfaction survey we did. We talk about the second phase, the learning assessments, the pre- and post-test. People go, why do the same questions on the pre- and post-test? Okay, sorry, it's a researcher in me. That's the way you have to do it. Okay, that's how you measure knowledge gain. And then if we got into three- and four-phase, here's time-like. This could be a year or months where we come back and say, do we go back and do audited observations and questionnaires of your brewers to find out if their behaviors have changed? And then we look at a change in incident frequency to see if there's actually been those results. So first of all, 15,000 lessons completed. Thank you, guys, in a year and a half. And here's all the different ones. You can see grain handling was number one, almost about twice as much. Mashing was about number two. Okay? So lots of, you know, when we break them down that way. So if I look at the satisfaction survey, I had about 1,700 to 1,800 people fill out the satisfaction survey. And this is on a 5-point scale, so this is 4. And guess what? We did pretty good from a satisfaction survey. Most of you guys were satisfied with all the different training modules. But when we look at meeting expectations, we see some low ones that we didn't meet the expectations here. We didn't meet expectations in bottling. So some of these, the lower numbers here, are from our, whether or not we met expectations. So that's something to look at from a training standpoint. Okay. And then we looked at the overall specific component satisfaction. You were least satisfied with the quizzes. And believe it or not, the online environment. Okay? People were least satisfied with doing something in an online environment. Okay? And, you know, maybe that speaks more to face-to-face. That was a surprising number. Okay? And that's a 3.9 roughly, and these other ones are 4.3. So is there some variation? I'm going to do a deeper one on these and do some statistics on them to find out if there's actually a, these numbers do vary as far as that. So then I looked at pre- and post-test. First of all, I asked you guys, what do you think you learned? What sessions did you learn the most from? And those sessions or whatever, you guys looked, and these are the sessions that had, overall, we had an increase, you know, from about 3.2 to a little over almost 3.7, where this one was the greatest, this one, you know, so carbonation, fermentation, cleaning, and I put these in order, filtering and that. This is where you guys said, I have the greatest knowledge gain. This is your perception, greatest knowledge gain. Okay. So then I compared the pre- and post-test results. Okay. Pre- and post-test results, we saw a 43% gain in knowledge from the pre-test to the post-test. Well, one of the things is you have to pass with 80%, so I keep taking it until I pass, right? Same questions, you know? So mashing had the biggest increase. That had, you know, had an increase. That was in the 80% increase, okay? Grain handling, okay, the grain handling one increased knowledge 120%. So that was huge compared to that. So you can see all the pre- and post-test scores and what they were overall. So we had good results with this, that you guys are showing that you had an increase in knowledge. And again, with certain lessons, less on bottling. Bottling was the lowest gain in knowledge from a pre-test and post-test. You did good on the questions at the beginning. You did good on the questions at the end. Not as much information. All right. So quick summary. Adults learn differently than children. Keep that in mind. Don't treat your brewers like children. We need to look at different styles that are out there. We need to think about learning outcomes to use for facilitated learning. We want to be able to understand that there are still going to be human error and there's still causes for it. And those are the kinds of things we need to work on. And again, we talked about the case results and how training effectiveness is measured. Again, tell me I forget, teach me I remember. Ben Franklin, involve me and I learn. All right. Questions that you guys have? Everybody goes, I'm keeping you between the beer, right now? Yeah. I'm not a firm believer in using videos without supplemental instruction, okay? Because videos can't cover it all. They can't cover your workplace specifics. So there are some good producers of videos out there, but to me, they all are too generic. You can use the Camtasia program and a couple of cameras, and you can make your own. Okay, and you know we've been making these. I'm using a film and video student, but you can make your own too. What's that? Yeah, I mean you look at what the OSHA guidelines say, and and then say, okay, this is what we want to train on. This is how we want to do it in our brewery. So you can do it, but there are some good ones out there. There, am I going to recommend anybody? I'm not a firm believer in them because too many times when people stick in the videotape, they walk away in your safety train. We just saw a documentary on a person that was killed in, his name is Day Davis, so he was killed in a Jacksonville Bacardi plant, in a bottling plant, and he was crushed by a palletizer. And the filmmaker came to and showed this to our students, and we talked about temporary workers. He was a temporary worker. So we talked about temporary workers, and he got crushed in this palletizer his first day on the job because he had absolutely no safety training. And during the documentary, they sent some guy from an activist group that went in to apply for a job at Waste Management in the recycling center to sort trash from a recycling standpoint. And he went into there, and he told them he couldn't speak English. And they sat him down in front of a video. They paid him for 3 minutes, and they told him how was it. He says, I don't know. I didn't understand anything. And they made him initial 20 different items and said he was safety trained. Okay. So that happens, and I'm not saying you guys do that, but that's what happens sometimes with videos. You plug it in, boom, done, got any questions? Okay, and most people are, probably have slept through half of it anyway because they're about 20 minutes to 30 minutes long. So, any other questions? Let's see how you do it. Hey, I got 3 minutes. Yeah.
Which is the best, say that in English. I speak Spanish for the first time. Which is the best way to track all the trainings for your staff?
Tracking training becomes a lot more difficult, because people need to be trained on certain subjects and you may have to have the proof of it. There are lots of tools out there. It depends on, your facility and how large it is. A lot of it can be done, fairly simply, but some stuff, if you've got a large brewery with a lot of employees, you're going to be looking for some solution. But there are many safety and health vendors that sell specific training tracking software and a lot of human resources vendors. Fire them. No. You need to get, you have to find some way to connect and get them on your side. And it may be talking to them about, potential risk. And, one of the things I use is that I ask people, if I'm doing the safety thing and I go up to somebody, they're going, oh no, here he comes. Okay. And I always start the conversation, you know why I'm talking to you? And they do. And they said, then I ask them to explain why it's important. And to get them to believe that. Yeah, some people are old school, and they're going to be real difficult, and it's just a matter of dealing with difficult beliefs. But if you get them on your side, okay, if they can see the benefit, okay, to them and their process and how they have to do it, you know, work out. Either that, I to give you an edge, we used to have a maintenance guy at one of the facilities I worked on, got injured all the time. This guy, this is the first time I saw an artery get cut. So if you've never seen that before, you're just going like, wow, what a fountain, okay? Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. I was more flat. I was just, you know, but we drew a chalk outline of him where he got hurt. You know, they all thought it was, you know, funny when after we took him to the hospital. But he kept getting hurt all the time. So what we did was we promoted him to the manager so he didn't have to go out and work with the tools anymore. And you know what? He was very successful at it, too. So, but, you know, that's an adage where, you know, but, yeah, difficult employees, I mean, there's not a panacea. I had one guy that, you know, he was never wearing his safety glasses in our tool room. And Dave was a huge guy. I mean, he would grab your hands and literally swallow your hands, okay? And Dave had a huge head to go along with this big bone structure. And he didn't wear safety glasses because he showed me they put indentations in the side of his head. Okay? So I went out and found him some safety glasses just for him that I went and purchased. He put them on. They didn't bother him or anything. And you want to know what? He was my biggest advocate for safety in the tool room that I could ever have. Because I did that one thing for him. Okay? Because he was, you know, it was a painful every day he was there. Yeah.
At the brewery I work at, we do a lot of like cross training and like shadowing, and there is some human error involved in that. I mean, you know, you're relying basically on someone else to train you.
Yep.
So, what are some other downsides of that, and also like what else could you be doing on the floor to train our employees?
Well, I mean, I don't think cross training is necessarily a bad thing. But you need to make sure you're spending enough time with people. You're showing people how to do things, okay? And, you know, and then having them repeat that so they understand it. So cross-training or training, you know, when you're actually doing a process or something like that, involve actually doing it. You know, and I'm horrible at it sometimes. I go, well, you just do this, 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 okay? My wife gives me your phone. She can't do it. I boom, 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 here. Give it back to her, okay? But you want to know what? She didn't learn anything. You know, so the next time it happens, what? My phone comes back again. Or her phone comes back to me again. Okay? So it's important for people to learn it, to understand it, because they have to learn it in their own way, and they have to understand it in their own way. So, you know, but, you know, cross-training is becoming more and more of a thing where people have to do multiple jobs in a facility. And I know that from a health and safety standpoint, we were doing a lot of other things than what we did in some of the companies I worked with than maybe what you thought you were going to do. And so I don't know if that answers your question or not, but, you know, it's to me, that's more of a skill. So if we look at the facilitated outcomes, that's going to be an actual doing of the job. It's the only way people learn. Yeah. It helps you understand your employees and where they're coming from so that maybe you can design your training around those particular things if you see some different types of things. I'm a firm believer in Gardner's multiple intelligences because it gives you a better spectrum rather than trying to put people in a box of introvert versus extrovert or something like that. So the Gardner multiple intelligences is something that's been out there for a while. And if people take the test, you can at least look at that. And I love that they do a visual of that.
It's then, much different than
DISC,
right?
The Detroit one.
I'm not positive what that one is.
I know what he's talking about. It's really similar to that. It's got the INJ.
That's that. The other one that's out there, the Paragon Adult Learning Theory, which is intuitive judging. You know, that judging, perceiving those. I like Gardner's a lot better. Gardner's was after this one. This Paragon Adult, this thing has been around for a while. Human resources people have used that one for a long, long time to put people in certain groups. And to some respects, it works, but then what do I do with it? You know, what do I do with it? And Gardner may give you a little more information, but to me, I'm a facilitated outcomes guy. I want to say, this is what I want the people to learn. This is how I need to go about it. And this is the way it's going to be best for everybody. Myers-Briggs, thank you. I was searching for it.
We have time for one more question.
How do you feel about positive reward programs for compliance to...
With safety?
With safety or with following other training things, following procedures.
What do you mean by positive reward programs?
Set up like, okay, if everybody follows the directions and does this the way that they're supposed to do, or if this one person does it the way they're supposed to do, then there's some sort of... benefit on top of and beyond their usual compensation in some form.
Reward programs from a behavioral standpoint can be good. If you look at behavioral psychology, there's, you know, that's, you know, you're reinforcing with a positive consequence. By the way, if you ever want to see Big Bang, there are no, it's not negative reinforcement. It's positive punishment. So I don't know if you, just search that for Big Bang. There's a nice YouTube clip on it. So it's, negative reinforcement is an oxymoron, but anyway. But in answer to your question is that, yeah, positive reinforcement can work, but it has to be perceived as fair by the people. So whoever you're rewarding or how we're rewarding has to be fair. It shouldn't be large. It should be small. It should happen all the time. So whenever they do the behavior, you have to be there to reinforce it. And that's not an easy thing to do. So that's the issues with behavior, with reinforcement. It can happen to some degree, but when you see something positive happens. You know, most of the time we're walking through our workplaces and we're hollering at the people that are doing things wrong, and we're never complimenting the people on doing things right. And that's what you have to get to with a positive rewards program. It's not easy to do, but it does have some benefit. So with that... I appreciate it. That's a reference, by the way, I have in my PowerPoint for ARNT, for Facilitated Learning Outcomes. I appreciate your time. Thank you.